Welcome to episode 4 of the Frontal Harvest podcast.
A podcast about science, technology, and education, and snow.
Snow. I'm Patrick.
And I'm Kelly. And together, we are the hosts of Frontal Harvest podcast.
So let's get started. Now, usually we do the blog entries first.
Okay.
And this was a smooth startup, which is cool. Because we had our show notes for the, that we didn't have last time. But you didn't have a couple things on your notes that I wanted to say. First of all, we keep forgetting the intro and the ending music was your idea.
Right.
And
it's Dire Straits.
That's right. Dire Straits, Love Over Gold. And it's just, I can't remember if I grabbed it from the start or the end, but it's a really cool.
I think it might be the start.
The start. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that's what we're using for the intro music and the ending. The other thing that we keep forgetting to mention is starting with podcast 2, I think it was, we got our new microphone. So I think the sound quality has been a lot better.
I think so.
It's a Samson, S-A-M-S-O-N. And let's
Luke
see.
Luke was quite impressed.
I know. Let me see. It's a, the model is GoMic. G-O-M-I-C. Yeah. And I thought, oh, this is funny. It sounds like Samsung, S-U-N.
Right.
You know, so is this some kind of a knockoff or something? And then Luke was like, no, no, this is really good for podcasting. So
right.
That was kind of funny.
It was. Luke is our son. He is our youngest son. And he is a techie.
Yep. Yep. I'm going to move this over. I'm getting hot.
Okay.
There. We're good. Okay, so we usually do this in three parts. We have our blog entries, and then topics of interest, and then future plans.
Right.
Which really, most of it is the topics of interest, but we'll start with the blog entries.
Okay.
So you'll go first. I have to say, I haven't read your entry yet.
You see? You should have read my blog.
I know, I should have.
Okay.
So, did you read mine?
No.
Fail.
So.
I think they're both up.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, I didn't read it. It's so funny because I checked it and then I didn't.
I'm not sure if they're both up, actually. I don't know if mine, because mine's not due until
next week.
No, until this Sunday.
This Sunday.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, we should say. So it's February 26th on Thursday. But we won't put the podcast up until Sunday. And it's still only available through our funky system that Isaac set up, our older son. So it's probably not going to be easy to get to for anybody for a little while still. But hopefully by this summer we'll have it up. But the date's... We're planning on Sundays, usually every other week. So, anyway, so your blog entry.
Okay, mine was on Bear Island. Bear Island is an island off the coast of North Carolina. It is in the southern coast of North Carolina, off of Hammock Beach. And it's about a 20-minute ferry ride over to the island. The island itself is about a mile long. Patrick and I take a canoe route or a kayak route, and it takes us about an hour and a half to 3 hours to get there, depending on how we hit the currents for the tides. And it is a place that we try to go yearly, and it is just a wonderful vacation that we have together, and it is a time to just turn off all of our daily routine and just go and...
Lots of nature, though.
Lots of nature and hang out in the beach.
Yeah.
And we've seen incredible stuff. So
it's February. Why are you blogging about this now?
Because we just booked our vacation in the summer, and we were going to plan it in early June, and the earliest we could book was mid-July,
yeah.
Yeah, so that was a shocker.
Yeah. Well, you could probably find some dates, but not for a whole week.
Mm-hmm. Right. And we wanted a whole week.
Yeah.
Right. Without having to move around campsites and that.
Yeah.
So we're, when we go there, we, have a very old canoe that we got on Craigslist. A Grauman. And, it is heaped full of just supplies, tent, everything that we need for the week, and sunshades.
And, you know, when we get over there, it's like there's no shade, right?
None.
You have to bring everything. You're directly underneath the sun.
Right.
And Grauman also built the LEM, and there's no shade on the moon. I'm just saying.
Anyway. See the parallel there.
See the parallel, yeah. We're going to the moon.
So, like Pat said, we get to see all kinds of wildlife. We're, we just really enjoy the marine, birds and just the whole coastal ecology of the area where we kind of wade in and we get to see things and
the crabs.
The crabs.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't remember the one, but, just a fun thing. We even got to see the island deer, the male deer.
Yeah.
Last year. Yeah. Snorting at us from the dune.
Well, for the first time last year, we actually hiked through the interior a fair bit. Mm-hmm. That was interesting.
It was
a very different ecology.
It was.
Lots of the tiny little cacti, so you've got to be really careful.
With big needles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I went... Well, yeah. We'll talk about it more in this summer. So
definitely.
Yeah. Okay. My blog entry.
Okay.
So last time I did it on Chlamydomonas reinhardtii, the green alga. And so I thought this time I'm going to write it on scientific names.
Named.
And it's partially for kids, starting eighth grade and going up higher. And partially also for college students, but like for anybody. But, you know, you come across a lot of people that are just, I don't want to use scientific names. I just want to use the regular names. And, which is fine, right?
Right.
And, but they turn off on scientific names and there's no reason to. Mm-hmm. There's no, and I guess, so you didn't read it yet.
No, but, I haven't.
Which is going to be usually the case because mine is always ends up being due on the date the podcast is due. So a lot of times that's going to be the case. But I guess the way I was thinking is that really there's no point in learning scientific names, right? If you're just doing it for interest and for knowledge, it'll just come, right? If you get interested in a scientific, in an organism that is big in science, the scientific name will just come. And if it doesn't, no worries, right? I mean, that's just the level you're at, but there's no point in really spending a lot of time. You know, if you enjoy memorizing stuff like that and you like making the connections that, relate some organisms to others, you know, through their genera, that's fine, right? But, so that's what I wrote about, you know, there's no reason to fear scientific names. They're really great. There's no reason to force yourself to learn them unless you have a class, right?
Right.
That's a totally different situation where you're forced to because you're being tested on it, and I'm not interested in talking about that. That's a different thing. But it's just for knowledge. There's a lot of fun stuff there, and saying them, I personally don't think it's hard at all. Mm-hmm. And the reason is, you know, when you first look at it, like any kind of name like Chlamydomonas, it's you can't figure out immediately how to say it. Mm-hmm. It takes a bit of time. And the point is to just break it down and then decide on a way to say it.
Right.
And not worry about whether it's right or not. Mm-hmm. You know, when you meet people that know how to say it, then you'll change.
Right. You'll correct yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was my blog entry.
Neat.
Do you have stuff in your class because, you know, from my point of view, a lot of the scientific names that I use for organisms, they're for organisms that don't have a normal name. You know, like, Chlamydomonas doesn't.
Right.
Caenorhabditis elegans doesn't, the roundworm. That's used in research a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Arabidopsis probably does, the plant.
We haven't really gotten to it yet. when we cover oceans, we just, you know, I usually have the scientific name as well as the common name. And, you know, we'll as a class try to say it together. I'll sometimes have it, you know, the dictionary voice say it, and then we'll say it together.
Do you have some organisms that you have to talk about that don't have a common name?
No. But it's just we're working with ecology and symbiotic relationships. So we're looking more at the relationship than the organism.
Right. Also, when you do your macro invertebrates, some of those, it's more like a group name for, right? Like you don't use the, well, you don't talk much about planaria, but planaria, that's like, is that a family or order name or a genus? I'm not sure. Anyway, planarians are, you know, that's definitely not what you'd consider a common name. It's not the name for a specific species, but no, it falls.
Oh dear, I forgot what I was going to say. There's something I was going to add in to what you were saying.
It's gone.
It's gone.
Okay, topics of interest?
Okay, so I read this article in AAAS Science about privacy, and it just made me think about, you know, when we carry around all of the electronics with us, especially the iPhones or the higher cost phones that keep us connected and show where we are with GPS and all of that, that it takes away a certain amount of privacy of just, you know, our movements through the day. And it made me really think about, you know, what are things that I think are important that should be private and kept private for the individual? And what are things that could be shared more publicly? And I remember having the discussion with you right after I read the article and really, you know, not knowing what, you know, what is important to keep us private.
Yeah.
Because, you know,
to a certain extent, you have to almost accept that some things you want to keep private, but there's no way to force them to be private.
Right.
Right. There's methods of gathering data that we can't imagine, I'm sure.
Right. And that's the other thing, is that in the more commercial, you know, realm of things, there's a huge amount of data being collected about the individual, about where they move within the internet, with their, what they're buying, and especially as the buying becomes more online shopping and that. And yet, as a researcher, it would take a lot of paperwork for us to be able to physically collect that data from the person and do it in what we would consider an equitable way.
Oh,
you know,
the article had a section about like how that data's, how researchers gather data also.
I started thinking about, because I remember all the paperwork that, you know, just for very simple data collections that we had to have filled out. And I was, you know, it's that thing like, well, if we're allowing a group of people for commercial reasons to be able to collect all of this data about an individual and yet not allow researchers that same ability, I just find it, I find it unfair. And also, I think it lacks in allowing people to really think through some interesting situations.
Yeah. The question is, like, you know, does it make sense to try to regulate the industry from collecting, right? Maybe it just doesn't make sense.
Right.
Because what are you going to do?
And I think there's that divide about, you know, there's the technology to collect all of this data. They're starting to really manipulate this data and ways they can use it, and yet our understanding of what data they're collecting and how they're using that data, there's this big divide that, you know, I would like to know more.
I've thought about this a bit. I'm not sure what to do on the research side, mm-hmm. because, the restrictions on researchers collecting data from individuals is a symptom of trying to regulate research because of abuses that have happened in the past, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's an overbearing situation, but mm-hmm. but how do you, that's just the natural way that humans deal with things like this. Bad things happen because people sometimes are underhanded or dishonest, and then you've got to do something.
There's a reaction to it.
So there's a reaction to the regulations. With having thought about it a limited amount, I kind of come down on the side of maybe the best way is to let whatever happen, whatever happens happen, and then make sure that there is laws that protect the individual. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you get all sorts of stuff on your computer that targets you specifically, you know, you should be able to deal with it, unless it's something where they get to your financial records or something like that. So I think the law should really concentrate on if you're targeted specifically and stuff is being done that starts to affect you. You know, I don't know where you put the limit.
Right.
But I think protection of the individual is probably better than trying to stop information from being gathered by the industry.
I agree.
So.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm still not sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, what else do you have?
Okay. And last weekend, we helped out with an orienteering event.
Yep.
And it was cold. I mean, cold.
Yeah, well, we were doing the starter.
We were doing registration.
And registration.
So you sit there for hours.
Well, I don't know about hours, but more than an hour.
More than an hour.
Probably.
Where you're just kind of, you can't really move from a table where you're getting information from people. Yeah. And it's good. It's just when it's cold, you need to move a lot more. Or wear a lot more clothes. Yeah.
It was definitely below freezing throughout the entire day.
Yeah. And then we got to participate in the event, which was nice.
We ran together. Which was fun. We don't usually.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And it was a great day.
Yeah.
It was a good day. And then we had to do pickup.
Yep. That's right.
Yeah. And pickup always has its own little craziness goes with it, where, you know, you will think that you've communicated what controls were going to be picked up by an individual with some, you know, and then
usually there's not a problem, but this time there was a control, at least, well, several left out.
Yeah. And I think it was just miscommunication where the person didn't realize what was expected. And
Ian had to go back out and deal with everything that got left out there.
Right.
So.
Yeah. And it was cold.
Yeah.
The poor guy.
And it was late.
It was late.
He's a
by
good
the
guy.
Time we're finished. He's a very good guy. And we will be asking him for much more help when it comes to ours. So that brings me to the upcoming OMEET. Where we have our permits. Yay! So now we just have to get the map finalized.
Yep.
And get the map on the program. Yep. So that it's all set. And
last few controls out there.
Yep. Last few controls. And I think we're in pretty good shape.
Yep.
Kind of afraid to say it.
I know. We'll see what
but
happens.
But I think we're okay. The other thing that we've recently purchased is the Humble Bundle.
Oh, and I forgot about that.
It was a group of science books. It was actually technology books.
Yeah.
And it was books about Python,
There was one about Ruby.
There's one about
soldering.
Yep.
And it was all for kids, actually, mostly. Yeah.
It was all these little graphic books. Like, they had little cartoons that inside, went along with them. One was setting up a web page. And I went through it, one of the ones on the web page, and very readable.
Oh, so wait a second. They were all from one publisher.
Right.
And they're ebooks.
They're ebooks.
But I suppose maybe you can buy them hard paper. I'm not sure, but do you remember the name of the publisher?
No, I don't.
Ah.
I do not.
Anyway.
Yeah.
They had a lot of good books. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm curious to see the reaction when you bring them into your eighth grade class.
And I have them on my tablet, and so that the kids can look through it during our enrichment makerspace time. So that should be good. The other thing is we just put together the Jedi Pi.
Jedi Pi, our newest Raspberry Pi. Well, so it's your Raspberry Pi.
It's my Raspberry Pi.
And it goes on an acrylic board we built, a year ago or more?
2 years ago.
2 years ago. Yeah. To hold a Raspberry Pi, and it's been holding one for a long time.
Right.
We moved it.
But it was hijacked by our son.
It was.
So I couldn't really use it. It was on the board, but he had a project going.
And the board has, you have a 7-inch screen.
Yeah, and a keyboard.
Keyboard.
USB.
USB, USB hub.
And the Raspberry Pi.
And the Raspberry Pi. And what else? That's it?
And extension cord.
Extension, right, the power strip.
Power strip,
And the wireless.
Yes.
Interface into the hub. And the mouse is part of the, it's just it's a touchpad on the keyboard. Yeah.
And it's a really nice system. I think the kids are going to be very excited about it and playing around with it. And it allows them to hook up a Pi very quickly and be able to do a few things on the Pi immediately, which is important because, you know, you want to make it.
So this is the tech part of So we need to say precisely what we did.
Okay.
So we bought the Raspberry Pi. We had all this other
Raspberry Pi B+.
B+. So that's the new one.
Which takes a mini SD card.
Mini SD or micro.
Micro.
Would they call them minis or micros?
Micros, I think. Micro. You're right. Micro.
So we got one of those. And then we downloaded the Raspbian operating system.
Right.
From the Raspberry Pi website.
Right. And
we burned it on the SD card using my laptop.
Right.
Right.
Windows doesn't work as well as a Linux system.
I think it probably would.
Oh, really?
It's just I've done it so much, right?
Okay.
And so
there's an extra download with the Windows.
There's an extra download.
And so it makes it a little messier.
Yeah. And we checked the MD5 sum, which was interesting because it was, I mean, it totally makes sense, but the MD5 sum they gave you was for the file in the zipped version.
And then we ran into problems.
Yeah, it didn't work.
Right, because we used a 32 SD card.
I don't think that's it.
Our SD card was messed up.
The SD card got messed up somehow.
And we have to reformat it before we use it for anything.
Yeah, yeah. But we tried it on a second SD card.
Right.
Did exactly the same thing, and this time it worked.
Right.
So.
Yeah. So we were really happy to have it up and running in just a few minutes. Yeah.
But I don't know if you remember, but we were trying all different things to see what was.
Oh, yeah.
Because, so this is the technical part, right? It wasn't as simple as just putting the SD card and starting the Raspberry Pi because we're using that 7-inch screen.
Right.
And it's one we got, I think, from Adafruit.
Right.
And we weren't sure whether anything would show up on the screen without changing the config.txt file in the boot.
Right.
And the boot directory. And the way I remember that, and the boot directory is a separate partition. And the way I the reason I remember that is because when we couldn't get it to work, like we'd plug it in, right? And then we got a black screen and nothing would happen. We took the card out and we mounted it on my laptop and we could go into the directory.
Right.
So something wasn't right, but we could read it like the file mm-hmm. system was fine as far as we could tell, but obviously something was not. And one of the things that we didn't know, which we figured out trying all different ways to get it to work, is that when you first apply power, the red LED comes on, and then the green LED blinks a bit, and then I think it goes off. And ours, when it wasn't working, it just stayed on the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know if that was right or not.
Mm-hmm. So we were starting to think that the Raspberry Pi itself was messed
right.
up.
And we put it in another Raspberry right. Pi we have.
Right, the SD card.
Yeah, the SD card. That wasn't working. And then the other Raspberry Pi didn't work either.
Right.
So we knew it was we thought it was the card.
We thought it was the card.
Yeah.
Switched out the card and we had a running system.
So those were our...
Our challenges,
yeah. But we got it figured out, and mm-hmm. now it's working. And then, so what did we do? We plugged in the Wi-Fi.
Right. We set up the distro. Is that what you would call it?
Yeah.
Like just the screen, you know, setting up, I guess, the way you want your desktop to look on the Raspberry Pi. So we have that.
Did we
all
do
set.
Anything?
We changed the screen color. We, you know, messed around with the font so we could read it instead of it being kind of this wasn't solid enough to read. So we just messed around with it to make it more usable.
Sudo apt get
update and.
Update and then upgrade.
Yeah. So we did both of those things.
So we upgraded everything.
Right, which is awesome. And then while I was waiting for the upgrade to take place, I went on and looked for articles just for the students to read.
Yeah, I remember.
I've always liked MagPie because they have a wonderful format that you can access all the magazines online. At no cost. And their articles have just been a lot of fun. And one that I read today, and it's a much older article from 2013, was about Amy Mathers. And
how old is she?
12 years old. She was an eighth grader.
So you were actually looking for one that had Limor Fried on the cover.
I was.
From Adafruit.
So I have one girl.
Yeah.
One tech girl in a group of...
It's tough.
...of 17 boys.
Yeah.
And I actually think that I would have had more girls if I would have went to the choosing of students for the group.
Yeah.
And I think they might have dished a few girls to keep my numbers at 18 for the equipment.
The people choosing where the kids go.
Because... of their bias about.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so now I'm kind of angry with myself because I didn't get much diversity and I didn't get many girls. And and I'm like, lesson learned. Next time I'll show up and I'll make sure those students are within it.
Yeah.
You know, they're all students that chose the
class. We have to maybe explain this. This is for a program at the school called
Enrichment
Club, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And they meet several times throughout the year.
Yeah, it's we only meet in the spring, mm-hmm. and we have six meetings. We meet twice a month. We have an hour meeting every 2 weeks.
And your Enrichment Club is going to be kind of a makerspace type thing?
Yeah, it's actually called the Makerspace Club.
So it's a little bit like the extension of what you have running at lunchtime throughout the year.
Yeah. And this was to open it up to a broader audience, including sixth and seventh grade students.
What I thought was really neat, I mean, talking about trying to get young girls into mm-hmm. technical subjects and stuff, and really in eighth grade, it's probably, would you say, almost not losing them?
Oh, no, I have a strong cohort of girls.
So you do?
Yeah, right. In eighth grade. So now I've had to learn a few tricks about getting the students there. So when I invite girls to go, I'm like, hey, maybe you can invite a few of your friends. I give them three passes at a time instead of one that I would give to the boys. Right. And the boys would show up because at that stage, they're less social than the girls that are of their age.
Right.
And so, you know, I've learned a few tricks, but I have a STEM program going, a STEM competition where they're building solar cars. And I have a group of five girls building a car.
Okay.
And
good.
There's only, I think, 12 kids in total.
Okay.
So I have a good base.
Yeah, that's like half almost.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm keeping it to just below, well, half to just below half.
What I remember when you were starting this out that I thought was really interesting about the girls is that you would get, I remember suddenly this whole group where it was all girls.
Yeah. So some weeks I'd have all girls.
Yeah.
And then it would swap back to, we can't make it this week. We have cheerleading and whatever going on. Or just, no, we aren't going this week, but we'll come back next week. Right. And so, you know, keeping that door open for those girls to just get the experience so they can really see if, you know,
what
they
feel confident.
Yeah, feel confident about if they're faced with something, building something or technology of any sort, they're ready to dig in.
Yep.
Yeah. So very good articles in Magpie. I'll go back to Magpie. And they have these great links that you can go through the articles and just go over to the webpage that they're referring to or the event that they're referring to so the students can get extra information. Very nice stuff.
Well, that sounds good. Mm-hmm. So, paper folding, because we have our show notes.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it's my topics of interest.
Yep.
Now. Oh, no, we're not done. Weren't you going to do snow?
Oh, snow. How could I forget?
Yeah. What have we been done all day? Because we haven't been at work.
No. So we have a state of emergency.
Which is how many inches of snow?
5 inches of snow in North Carolina.
So that's what?
Maybe six.
2.5. So that's 10 and 2.5. That's like 12, 13 centimeters.
Right. And
it doesn't. Yeah, it seems like it'd be that much easily, actually.
So
I could say actually more than that.
I think so. That's what I said. It might be a little more.
It was really sticky stuff this morning. Yeah.
Nice, thick snow. Like something you can go and ski on.
Yeah.
And that's just what we did.
Yeah.
So we woke up. We noticed a pile of snow. We expected it from looking at the weather. And we, after breakfast, we got our skis down, and then we searched for an hour and a half for our boots.
See, that's what happens when you're in North Carolina. Three or four years go between cross-country ski outings.
And then we hit the trail, which was fabulous. We had a wonderful ski. We skied for two hours, a little over 2 hours, and...
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful conditions.
So I have to say
for
this.
Here. Yeah.
Because for all of you people that are in those border states where snow comes only maybe once every 4 or 5 years, and you go out and you go for a walk in the park and it's just so nice. And then you notice cross-country ski tracks. Stay out of the tracks. Oh, I could just such a freaking pick. No. Okay. So.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to get angry because people don't know around here.
Right.
It's not that big a deal, except, well, when it freezes, it makes it a big deal, actually.
Yeah. You can't maintain the tracks for too long.
No.
Yeah.
It definitely shortens our season.
It does.
Our season.
All of 1.5 days.
1.5 days. Yeah. Anyway, so, and the birds were going crazy around the feeder.
Yeah, we I've been putting out seed.
So I was going to do my topics of interest next, but maybe this is a good segue into my topics. This is kind of both of our topics, is the birds.
Yeah.
So we've been getting into checking out bird lists again.
Right.
Just this last week, with it being so cold, well, you've been making sure that they get their seeds.
Right.
And the flocks, the multi-species flocks we're getting out there, it's been fantastic.
Yeah, it's been huge.
Yeah.
And last weekend, we even had 100 robins stop by.
Oh, that's right. I remember you counted.
Isn't that cool?
It was a gigantic flock. And then they moved on.
They moved on. Right. But I've never seen that many robins altogether.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wanted to have a list kind of like of how many genera we saw and stuff, because it was interesting, but I didn't get around to it. But off the top of our head, what did we see? I mean, what do we have as regular visitors? We had obviously chickadees.
Juncos.
Juncos. Slate, call it juncos. Yeah. We have white-crowned and white-throated sparrows.
Right.
Cardinal. Northern cardinal.
Mr. and Mrs.
Yeah. Rufous-eyed towhee, white-breasted nuthatch,
Eastern bluebird.
Oh yeah, we have an eastern bluebird. We don't see them very often.
No.
We have the woodpeckers. We have
downy.
We have
red-bellied
woodpecker, yellow-bellied sapsucker.
Right.
No flickers.
No, but we have a thrush.
Do we? I don't remember. I didn't put a thrush on the list.
You didn't?
I mentioned when I was looking through the taxonomy, one of the species that we put down is actually in the thrush family, and that was the surprise for some reason.
Okay, that's why.
That's when I mentioned thrush. I can't remember what it was.
Don't we have nuthatches?
The white-breasted nuthatch. Mm. You know, I've always wanted to, but I've never seen a red-breasted one.
No.
I think they're more in coniferous forests. Mm-hmm. We used to go skiing on purpose, you know, in areas, and I wanted to see one, but never have. Tufted titmouse, not a big deal. House finch.
Yep.
Rufous-eyed towhee.
Yep, you mentioned that.
Oh, did I? Okay. Yeah. I'm probably forgetting a couple.
I think so, and I can't remember what they are. Oh! Blue jay.
Blue jay, yeah. Anyway, and then I started to look up a great resource, which is the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And I remember knowing about them when we were studying ornithology at St. Lawrence University. I don't know if you remember having the tapes of the bird calls.
Yes.
But that was not when we were studying ornithology.
No. We bought them after.
Well, some people were listening to them at St. Lawrence, but not while we were taking the class. But I remember some people having access to them. We got interested in it after, and Dr. Green was teaching us about them when I went to Maine for the boreal ecology course. And Dr. Kroll taught us to recognize some of them, but that was not really extensive.
No.
Anyway, but their websites now are fantastic. All sorts of information about the birds and identifying them. And they have fantastic, you know, I like their maps, their range maps better than the ones out of the Peterson book.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, because they have a separate color for migratory route. So you have summer, winter, and then, you know, when they're present both summer and winter, and then you have a different color for migratory route, which would be transient just during those times. So, yeah, it's a really good website.
Neat.
So we'll probably do more with that type of stuff. Well, you know, you were interested in putting together a Raspberry Pi with one of those cameras to do some triggered photography of wildlife, and maybe that will be our first project, is to have one of those bird boxes with a camera.
That would be fun.
Stuff. Yeah, that would be cool. Anyway, so we're into my topics in earnest now. I know I wrote the blog about the mini modules,
mm-hmm.
and we talked about the OshPark ATmega module, and I've basically done almost no work on that, just been busy with other things. But I did build, one of the things I said I would do is to build a mini module for just the crystal, mm-hmm. the surface mount crystal that I'd never worked before. So I built that and haven't tested it yet, but I will put that onto one of the regular ATmega 328 that has its own circuit where I can pull mm-hmm. out the crystal, and I'm going to put that module instead. And so we'll see what happens, and hopefully that works. And, you know, I thought maybe the reason they're not working, I think I mentioned that in the OshPark boards, maybe there's just less copper in the traces compared to some of the other ones, right?
Oh, maybe.
And so when I'm soldering it on, this might be the very first time there's so little copper connecting to the feet, which means maybe I'm overheating the chip, not realizing it, because I've never had enough. I've always had more heat sinking than I have.
Right.
So I thought one thing I can do, I mean, it's a fair bit of work, is to desolder an entire chip and then put it on one of the breakout little boards from Adafruit, which we got, because mm-hmm. some of those did work.
Right.
And I have an ATmega on one of those. So if I take it off that and put it on to the Adafruit one and it works, it withstood the heat of both the soldering onto the OshPark board, the desoldering, and then the soldering onto the mm-hmm. Adafruit board. I suspect it's going to work. I'm really at a loss as to what the issue is, but, you know.
I think it's something we're overlooking. But
something we're overlooking, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, eventually we'll get through it. So I just wanted to mention that, even though there hasn't been mm-hmm. a lot of progress. I'm going to skip this. I said I was going to do some stuff with OpenSCAD mm-hmm. for building this thing over the desk. Actually, I've worked with OpenSCAD again at work.
Oh, really?
Yeah, someone was asking for what are the dimensions of one of the little pieces that we've built
mm-hmm.
for cell culturing in a special way to cause coordination of cells and transport. And I had made an OpenSCAD 3D thing some weekend so that I could, you know, see exactly what the shape was and mm-hmm. turn it in different ways and stuff. And this lady sent an email saying, oh, I'm building a holder for it. You have the dimensions. So I just sent her the SCAD file.
Nice.
And, you know, I wrote in some of the dimensions also and sent a picture of the rendering mm-hmm. of the model. But that was fun.
Nice.
So what else? So this is kind of interesting. We talked a bit about my trip to Texas
mm-hmm.
Last time. But what we didn't mention is something that was really neat. I was on the... I don't think we talked about this, did we?
No, we didn't.
No? Okay. So I was on the plane, and we had a stop in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on the way from Atlanta to Raleigh, the RDU airport, which is between Raleigh and Durham. And I think it was about 15 minutes out. And I'm looking out the right side of the airplane, and I see this gigantic hyperbolic cooling tower with the condensing water coming out of it. And I'm like, and there's a kind of a lake there. And I'm thinking, well, it doesn't look like Lake Jordan. But I think we looked it up, and there's a Lake Harris. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, there's a nuclear power plant there. And it's we wrote it down, the Sharon Harris Power Plant.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of neat.
Yep.
To see that from the plane coming down and to recognize it. And you could see it was right on a peninsula. So it must be getting its water from there. And then the other thing that we found out is that I think there's four reactors on Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania.
Right.
And I think two of them, since the accident, have been permanently shut down.
Shut down, yeah.
And I think the other two are still going.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the ones that where the reactor was damaged, the electrical generator from that, so I'm not sure what that means, if it's the whole, the turbines and you know, the spindle with all the magnetic wire and all that to generate electricity, or if it's maybe just that part, but it was refurbished. I think I found out from Wikipedia. And it was sent to another nuclear power plant to be installed there. And it was this power plant, and I was like, this sounds kind of familiar. And it was the Sharon Harris plant. So just a few, well, I mean, a few, what, how many miles is is that from us? It's probably in less than an hour's drive.
Oh, yeah. Anyway. It's about half hour, 40-minute drive.
40-minute drive or so. So that's where one of the generators from the, from one of the reactors that had the accident at Three Mile Island back in 1970s, I guess. Anyway, so that was interesting. What else? So, nuclear power plant. So, when I'm on these long trips, that's something else I didn't write about. But, you know, I just like to work problems when I'm bored. And I mean, I'm not bored. I'm just enjoying myself. But when I just have to sit and, I don't know, different mathematical or physics problems, or sometimes chemistry, although that's not usually the case because you need, tables and stuff to do chemistry. But, so I was doing some, vector work, started to learn about affine spaces again, which it seems like I have to relearn. I still don't understand. I use properties that people that I read have to do with affine spaces, but I really don't understand exactly what the point of them is. But one of the things that was fun is that, I was just out of my head trying to figure out these solids of revolution, trying to figure out volumes. And Luke had been studying those at the same time. I think it was pretty much at the same time.
Yeah.
Because when he came back, he said, oh, yeah, I, you know, I had this calc to do and stuff, and asked him, and it was solids of revolution. And
figuring
out,
was pretty cool.
The volumes using integrals. So that was kind of fun and synchronicity. My next topic. Oh, this is something that I'm so excited for and I keep forgetting. So I wrote the script that loads up the page, the text from a web page where they report what's the latest release critical bug count for the Debian distribution. And I know exactly which line, you know, what words show up in it when they say what's the bug count for the latest, well, for the upcoming release. And so the script looks for that line and then figures out what the number of bugs is. And then it uses the local mail to mail me a little message telling me what's the bug count. So every morning I get a email and you see it going up and going down, and I think we went down to 147 bugs just recently, and then I think it went back up to 154 or so, but it hasn't been up to 160 again for the last couple weeks, so
right
you know, in the next couple months maybe. I don't know, maybe longer. But so Debian, the next release is coming up, that'll be a lot of fun. What else? Yes, my tablet.
Yeah.
So I tried to, root it, and I think I did. I kind of, I I didn't work at it a ton, but it really wasn't obvious exactly. I had new stuff on there. I had control over some stuff I didn't have before, but I think I'll leave it for now because I really don't know what I'm doing with it yet.
Right.
So that'll, but that will be some very interesting stuff to report on, technical stuff when I finally figure out how to control everything on there. And what else? Well, I think that's almost it. I have two other things maybe. So we were watching YouTube videos, and this is like highly technical talk having to do with linguistics, the science of linguistics.
Oh, yeah.
And specifically, we were watching a great set of videos where Mark Okrand, O-K-R-A-N-D, I guess he's a linguist. He was talking about a lot of linguistic properties.
And he's an expert.
And he's an expert on which language in particular?
Klingon.
Klingon. Kapla! I had to say it. Success! I think that's what it means. Anyway. So he had this great story about, I think he used to do, what did he used to do? He was doing translations on websites or something, or I can't remember.
I can't remember.
But somehow someone, I think for the second or the third Star Trek motion picture.
Right.
They needed someone to do, it wasn't Klingon. The first thing he did, it was, what's Spock? Vulcan.
Vulcan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He has this great story where they had shot a scene between Spock and Lieutenant, whatever, I can't remember the name. And they're both Vulcan, and they were speaking in English, and then they decided, oh, we want them to be speaking to each other in Vulcan with subtitles, and they contacted him and asked him, we don't want to reshoot the scene, so we want you to come up with Vulcan words
exactly
that match the lip motions that they're doing in English, so we don't have to reshoot the scene, then we can dub over the Vulcan, and that was just funny. So but it's really neat how he tried to keep all these linguistic properties, and it's funny, he on purpose broke some to make Klingon sound different.
He modified it depending on what the actors were saying, misspoke their lines, he would adjust the language to better react to what was being used. And he considered it the way any modern language would change over time, was rapidly.
Way, way faster, yeah.
I thought it was a riot.
Yeah, that was a blast. Yeah. So the other thing, this is going to be really short because it's actually a while since I've seen this, but it was interesting. It was a news feature on Wikipedia, which I followed to the source. Supposedly, limpet teeth. So I guess these are structures on limpets that are part of their radula. I think limpets have a radula, or maybe it's an analogous structure. Okay. But I think they do. So it's, you know, they use it to eat. I don't know what limpets eat. Do they just scrape the substrate, or do they actually eat attack organisms that have shells? I don't know.
I'm really not sure.
Anyway, their teeth have now been found supposedly to be the structures with the highest tensile strength, where before it was spider silk. And the original article is actually available to the public, and it's Royal Society. Oh, you're on the website.
Well, I just pulled up yeah, something yeah. about them.
Yeah. Well, so if you go down the, so we're on the Wikipedia article. There's they are. So if you go to the Wikipedia article for limpets, halfway down, there's a section on teeth. Mm-hmm. And there's a picture of the limpet teeth. Yep, it says, found on the radula, grazes. So I guess it just, oh, algae. So they eat algae.
Okay.
And they use that to scrape algae off of rocks.
Right.
And let's see. It's, well, we're not going to go into there, but yeah, some people published some article in the Royal Society where they, Royal Society, one of their journals, and they made some measurements on those teeth.
Right.
And it's a new record, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So,
tensile that, strength.
Yeah.
Nice.
So that's all I have.
Oh, that's neat.
Yep. And I had nothing for future plans for you because I didn't know what you'd put. For me, all I had is, we talked a bit about a few. I still want to do the open SCAD for the desk. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the OSH Park is pretty big.
Mm-hmm.
The OSH Park board that's not working right now.
Right.
I mean, it's my construction of it that's not working. Let's be clear here.
Mm-hmm.
And the old meat, still we have some work to do. Right. So that's all.
There's a few things that I've been working at school. One is getting iNaturalist going. So I.
Is this iNaturalist? Like the letter I? Yeah.
The letter I. It's a website that you can go to and you, join a project, and ours is Bowling Creek. And, the students going around Bowling Creek can take pictures of organisms and upload them to the project. And the cool thing is when you upload your picture, the website will, you can write in the name, or you can put, I don't know what this is, and there's specialists that will look at it and put the correct name.
Oh, that's really cool.
With the image, if the image is clear enough, of course.
Yeah.
But
it's probably handy to have images from different directions.
Right. Right. So, my goal, well, we got a grant from Bright Ideas,
mm-hmm.
and we have 7 cameras that students can go out in the field and take pictures and then upload them to iNaturalist.
So how does this work with the project? You said, so yours is the Bowling Creek project. Is
right.
that something that was already part of iNaturalist?
No, I made it.
So you guys made that.
So I set it up and then of course we got snow.
Right, right.
And there's not a lot of things that are moving without having a bird feeder. Yeah. Like, it's very difficult to catch birds.
We didn't see any deer.
No, no.
I was looking over to the side while we were skiing.
Yeah, I was too.
We didn't see any deer. But anyway, so, iNaturalist.
So, okay. I'm trying to populate the iNaturalist page, getting students to populate it. And we have an iPad cart, and I got them to upload iNaturalist to that, to the iPads. So the kids could take the iPads out and use them as well.
And iNaturalist is a site that anybody could use?
Yeah, it's wonderful.
It's not just for schools?
No. And I found out about it at a teacher workshop, and the North Carolina Museum of Natural Science has an iNaturalist project that we went on, and we could take pictures and upload them to it. So when I found out how that worked, I thought, wow, this will be a neat way of adding the ecology of the area and, you know, food webs.
Sure.
And things like that to our water quality. So.
Well, that sounds good.
Yeah. So I'm very excited about getting into that. That's a future plan because we're still waiting for the weather. And I think I have everything set to go. And I actually have the after-school students ready to go when the weather is right.
When that gets enough stuff on it that, you know, from your kids, that might be a fun blog entry to explain, yeah, you know, what your experiences were with that. And
right. And right now we're waiting.
Yep. Okay, so I think we can wrap this up.
Okay.
Okay.
So thank you for listening to the Frontal Harvest podcast.
Make sure you check our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.